I was watching the History Channel a couple days ago, and they had an incredible documentary about the possibility of more terrorism, of nukes being used in this country. It's a remarkable story. And we're going to have a remarkable evening with our special guest tonight, Richard Miniter, as we talk about his work. He is an internationally recognized expert on terrorism. And we'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. I'm George Norrie. I'm going to tell you a little bit about our guest tonight, Richard Miniter, and then he can tell you a lot more about himself. He is an internationally recognized expert on terrorism. He's the author of Losing Bin Laden in Shadow War and Mastermind. The 9/11 Commission used his work as key documents in putting together the 9/11 Commission report. And according to a commission spokesperson, Mr. Miniter broke news with his investigative reporting for the award-winning investigative team of the Sunday Times of London. It was a four-part series. It was called The Road to Ground Zero. Here's Richard Miniter on Coast to Coast. Richard, how are you?
Hi, George. Good to be with you.
Likewise, too. Likewise. Tell me a little bit more about you and your background.
Well, I was a reporter and a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. I joined the Sunday Times of London investigative team, the famous Insight team there. We won some international investigative awards for looking into 9/11, the causes. And the great thing about writing for a British newspaper into 9/11 is that we didn't have to take on any of the views of the American establishment. We were free to go much broader and much deeper. And ultimately, we came up with a 90,000-word, four-part series that won a lot of awards both in the United States and in Europe. And then I went on to write a book called Losing Bin Laden about the 13 different opportunities that President Bill Clinton had to take out bin Laden prior to 9/11 and why he didn't do it.
Yeah, we'll get into some of that tonight, too, because that fascinates me. When you hear the phrase conspiracy theorists, that these folks who, you know, believe that either 9/11 was an inside job or that there was some knowledge, they turned their heads, or that, you know, the buildings were wired, do you shudder, Richard, or do you say, well, maybe there's something there?
Well, I think part of the problem with the internet is that we assume that everyone has access to great amounts of information and is able to act on it. And I think what first of all, there are conspiracies, right?
No doubt.
I do agree that there are some. But I think what people don't fail to realize is that individuals can be smart, but people in groups can be dumb. And when you put people in an institution, a series of competitive agencies called the U.S. federal government, it reduces the average IQ of everyone in it. It's a kind of pyramid of fear. So while individuals might start to connect the dots and say, hey, there seems to be something here, the downward pressure from their boss is, well, let's not step out, let's not say anything contrary, and let's not say anything different. And so until you really understand how the U.S. government and how European and Arab governments work, it's, you know, from the outside, you see the information and the evidence, and you say, whoa, wait a minute, how could they not have known this? Mm-hmm. They must be covering it up. Well, I think different parts of the government knew different things, but they didn't cooperate with each other, because the government is really a pyramid of fear.
Sure.
And big corporations can act like pyramids of fear, too. That's why big organizations, labor unions, governments, businesses, can do incredibly dumb, incredibly shocking, and sometimes dangerous things, because they have a lower intelligence than an individual, if you know what I mean. It's a herd mentality takes over. So I think conspiracy theorists, as they're sometimes called, are a useful corrective in our society, in the sense that they sort of point at the information the establishment doesn't want to hear, and they can be useful for holding the establishment accountable.
It's a good point.
But on the other hand, some of the things that the conspiracy theorists come up with are not really well grounded in fact, and I'm prepared to debate that.
Okay, we've had all kinds of people on this program. And I may very well want to get you back with some of those people who claim to be experts in their own field to have you argue with them. But maybe you may agree with them, though. So we'll have to find out.
It depends on what they have to say.
I mean, for example, I'm baffled by Building 7. I don't understand how that building that was not hit by a plane could collapse like that. I've never seen a building collapse like that unless it was a controlled demolition or something hit it.
Well, something did hit it. I mean, the bottom 10 stories of the building were scooped out by wreckage from the plane. The NIST did an extensive study. It's a U.S. government agency. There was a fire that burned on the fifth floor for more than 8 hours. There was an emergency generator on the fifth floor, a diesel-powered electric generator, that was linked to a pressurized line all the way to the basement. And in that basement was a huge reservoir of diesel. And so it was believed that that fire, and there was no firefighting. The firefighting was concentrated on the two World Trade Center towers. So Trade Center 7 never got any real attention from the New York Fire Department. Remember, the building was largely unoccupied. Everyone had emptied out of Building 7 within an hour of the second plane crash. So by 9:45, that building was empty. It wasn't seen as urgent. They were still trying to evacuate people from the towers. And that had been where the focus was. So nobody was putting out the fire in Building 7. That fire raged for at least 8 hours. And like I said, it was fed from a pressurized diesel line. And at the same time, the southwestern corner of the building had been taken out, as had about 10 stories, about 25% of the front of the building. If you look at the video...
Now, what took that out? How did that happen?
From the World Trade Center.
Has it collapsed?
No. Everyone looks at the video of, usually just the video of the first plane hit. But as that plane hit, pieces came off the building and off the plane and collided into various buildings. And there's something like 27 buildings, I'd have to check the exact number for you, that got some damage from different bits of debris that came off.
From the momentum of the plane crash, I guess.
Right. I mean, you know, Newton's second law, right? Force equals mass times acceleration. And then, of course, as the fire raged, especially in the North Tower, bits of that building came off as well. And then when the towers collapsed, there was a third impact into a World Trade Center 7. So about 25%, about 10 stories of World Trade Center 7 are taken out. And then the structure of the building is a series of columns, which were only rated to take 2,000 pounds per square foot. And if you look at the video of the collapse of the building, you'll see that World Trade Center 7 doesn't collapse straight down as you would see in a controlled demolition. It collapses diagonally, and that's because it is folding in on its weakened face.
Like a chopped tree?
So like a chopped tree. Well said, yes. So, I mean, this is, you know, the NIST report is publicly available. I mean, it's hundreds of pages of engineering diagrams and so on, but it's fairly credible. And what I would like to see, I mean, first of all, I think, you know, I think people who say, let's not debate this, are idiots. I think the way to advance public discussion is to have free and open debates. I'd like to have somebody go through that report and show me, and present a compelling case as to why that report is wrong.
Right.
Instead of saying, okay, it's mysterious how Building 7 collapsed, therefore, you know, it must be a conspiracy, it must be a controlled demolition.
Would it be foolish at this point to call for a new 9/11 commission?
I don't think it would. I think it's always good to end mysteries. I mean, I think the government should release everything it knows about the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Blue Book and so on. I mean, look, we pay taxes to these guys, right? Now, I can understand you don't want to release documents about ongoing criminal investigations. You don't want to release documents about fundamental national security issues. But, you know, 9/11 happened more than 10 years ago. And there are really no foreign sources of information that would be compromised. I'd like to see a new 9/11 commission, but one composed not of tired politicians from the two parties, as we did in the first 9/11 commission. I mean, I respect the 9/11 commission's work for the most part.
I want to see experts, engineers.
Yeah, I'd like to see. Let's get some engineers. Let's get some physicists, some structural experts, And let's have an honest inquiry. You know, and frankly, some of the critics of the established view should be part of that mix, too. And let's have an open debate where, you know, arguments get presented. And I think if you did that, I think at the end of the day, I think any reasonable person would be satisfied that Building 7 was collateral damage brought on by the 9/11 attacks and not through any mysterious black bag job.
I want to get your reaction to the hunt for bin Laden now that we have him and he's fish food these days.
Yeah. If I could add just one more thing here, too. I mean, one of the things that always got my attention about the 9/11 truthers is this idea that it was a false flag operation by the CIA or by Mossad or someone, and therefore, you know, it was needed as a pretext to go to war. And what I find fascinating about that argument is that since when has the U.S. government needed a pretext to go to war? I mean, what pretext was there to go to war in Libya earlier this year?
Well, I think what they meant by that was that something needed to shake the American mindset, whether it was a Gulf of Tonkin episode or something needed to get the American people to rally around the flag. And but you're right. I mean, the U.S. can go to war anytime it wants, at any place.
And for better or for worse, it does.
And it does. I mean, you know, we decide to go into Libya, we go into Libya.
Why are we intimately involved in who's the next president of the Ivory Coast, a country in West Africa whose largest export is cocoa? And yet, you know, President Obama spent a vast amount of diplomatic energy together with the French to oust the current president and bring in his rival, who lost the election. He replaced a Christian president with a Muslim president. But, you know, why does Ivory Coast, you know, doesn't have any oil. Its biggest export is cocoa. Why did we get involved there? You know, I mean, I think you can ask lots of hard questions about what the government does and why it does it.
And I think
you didn't need a pretext to do that.
But I think people are just... they just don't trust government anymore, Richard. See,
I don't trust the government.
No. I mean,
frankly, I'd like to pay less in tax. I'd like to see less regulation. And, you know, I think the best person to govern me is me.
That's
right. The best person to govern George Norrie is George Norrie.
You got that right. See, I've always looked at who benefits when events happen. And we're going to get into the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed story because it's a fascinating work that you did with Mastermind.
Thank you.
But I always look at who benefits from events that happen. And you look at the things that have unfolded since 9/11. I mean, it's a textbook for somebody to take advantage of a situation.
You're right, George. But the interesting question is, who did benefit? You could argue, and there are people in the CIA and in the American intelligence community, and there are people in the Arab intelligence community who I've heard this from, that the main beneficiary of 9/11 is Iran. Now, you might say,
maybe.
How do you figure that one? Well, you know, here's their argument, that Iran got the U.S. involved in Afghanistan against the Taliban. Remember, the Pakistanis supported the Taliban. Mm-hmm. The Iranians supported the Northern Alliance. We went in on the side of the Northern Alliance,
that's right,
drove the Taliban out. Now, you look to the other side of Iran, its main enemy was Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
We took him out, giving the Iranians unparalleled influence on its two neighbors, right? The largest foreign donors to Iraqi political parties are Iranians. The British complained that their troop movements were reported in Iranian newspapers before the orders of those movements had reached back to London, right? You know, I interviewed...
That probably happened.
That happened quite a bit. I mean, I've heard that repeatedly from both Americans and British officers in Iraq. I made six different trips to Iraq during the war. The influence they have in Afghanistan is extensive and growing, largely on the backs of U.S. troops. They have a new standing. I mean, you have President Obama reaching out to them as they're building their atomic bomb, offering them every imaginable diplomatic concession, including a new student visa program to bring Iranian scientists here to the United States to study.
I mean, they've got to be finished with their power plants by now.
You'd think. Yeah. You'd think. I mean, it's remember, physics and engineering are different things, and in theory, building an atomic power plant is pretty well mapped out. But the engineering, getting the metal quality and the software, and just putting those pieces together, is very hard without a large industrial base. I mean, we were able to do it, the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans, the South Africans, because they had large industrial bases. Iran never had one, so it's a lot harder for them. And there's been some sabotage, too. But my point is, you can argue, and there are people in the Middle East and in the U.S. intelligence who benefited from 9/11? Iran. I mean, it's really tricky to try to figure out who benefited. I can tell you who didn't benefit. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense. I mean, he took the job from Bush in January 2001 with the goal of transforming the military, getting rid of the bureaucracy, changing the way it operates. I mean, he had been Secretary of Defense before in the Nixon and Ford administrations. He wanted another crack at taking on the military-industrial complex. He did not want to be distracted and go to war.
What about Cheney?
Well, again, Cheney, it's hard to see how he particularly benefits in that he was mostly concerned before 9/11 with trying to get Bush to sign on to Social Security privatization and some other domestic policy initiatives. I mean, everybody else was focused somewhere else. The CIA certainly didn't like it because it suddenly brought to everyone's attention the fact that they really did a really poor job for close to 30 years in tracking Islamic terrorism. And so you go through, it's hard to find winners in the U.S. government. We can debate it. You know, there are certain sub-agencies that certainly did better. The National Reconnaissance Office got new satellite and a new facility out near Dulles International Airport. I mean, there's some parts of the intelligence community that certainly benefited. But, you know, they're surprisingly minor. But if you look at foreign countries that benefit, you know, you'd say, well, Iran. You'd look at China, right? China was able to gear up its military, was able to crack down on the Muslim rebels in its far western reaches.
Quickly, too.
Yeah. So, you know, and without any criticism from the U.S., you know, and of course they got the only superpower in the world distracted.
There seems to be an unwritten rule among some of the superpowers, Richard, that we'll do our thing, you do yours. We won't complain about yours, and you turn your head when we do our thing. It's almost as if they've cut up part of the world and they say, okay, you can have that. And you can have that, and you can have that. I mean, nobody said anything when the Russians went into Chechnya to do what they had to do.
Yes. When they went into South Georgia, there was a different question.
Yeah.
There is this sort of 19th century sense of spheres of influence to an extent. Although I think the Russians and the Chinese are pretty active in opposing anything America does anywhere in the world. There is sort of an understanding by the Americans and the Europeans that we're going to ignore what happens in Tibet and the human rights abuses there, or the ongoing murder of Christian tribesmen in Burma by the thuggish government there, which is backed by China.
See, I'm not sure we would do anything to China if they went into Taiwan. What do you think?
Boy, if we wouldn't, it would mean that being an ally of the United States is a fool's game.
That's true.
Now, I mean, if the Chinese did something like take the two islands of Matsu and Kamoi, which are technically part of Taiwan but lie only a mile or so off the coast of China, if you remember, Vice President Nixon in the 50s and Eisenhower had promised to go to war to defend Matsu and Kamoi. Mm-hmm. If the Chinese were to suddenly take those islands tomorrow morning, would President Obama do anything? My guess is that he would not, and I'm basing that.
Hold on for one second, Richard. We're at the break here. We're going to come right back with you. Richard Miniter, our special guest, his book, Mastermind. We haven't even gotten into that yet, but we will. Hey, you Coast Insiders. On our next night, it'll be Wednesday at 8 p.m. Pacific time. Coast Insiders paranormal researcher Joshua P. Warren will be our special chatting guest. You know, we do that a couple times a month. And so get there early. Starts at 8 p.m. Pacific time. Coast Insiders. You know how to do it. If you don't, go to our website. You'll figure it out. It's very easy. But Joshua P. Warren will be there taking your questions and answering as quickly as he can. And welcome back. We're with Richard Minotaur. Richard, before we get into your work mastermind here, let's finish up on China, where we talk about the possibilities if we would say anything if China took a couple islands from Taiwan. I don't think we would either.
I don't think we would. I base my view on this, that when the North Koreans attacked our ally, South Korea, remember we have something like 37,000 U.S. troops in South Korea guarding the DMZ and in other places in that country. When they attacked, they raked an island with gunfire, killing dozens of South Koreans, and then later went on to sink a naval vessel of South Korea. Classically, that's an act of war.
That's right.
Alleged sinking of ships had led us into more wars than anything else, right?
That's true.
The Spanish-American War with the bombing of the Maine, or the alleged bombing of the Maine, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, whether you agree that happened or not, or as the Johnson administration describes, it was an attack on U.S. shipping, allegedly. That led us into a much deeper involvement in Vietnam. The sinking of U.S. Ships and helped propel us into World War One, and of course, attacks on U.S. shipping at Pearl Harbor led us into World War Two. So, typically, attacks on shipping of allies of the United States would be seen as an act of war, and Obama didn't react at all. I think there might have been a diplomatic démarche or something like that.
Yeah, they let the South Koreans shell back a little bit, and that was it.
That's right, and maybe that would not have happened without a fair degree of South Korean pressure, by the way. So I hate to say that the President of the United States probably would not react militarily to China's seizure of those islands. And the failure for the U.S. to act in East Asia when its allies are attacked makes the world much more dangerous for every American in it, because it calls into question every security guarantee we've ever made, including NATO. Whether those guarantees are wise or not is a different question. But once you make them and those promises are not ironclad, it calls into question the entire international system.
Which leads us into the killing of bin Laden. And then we're going to set the stage with your work mastermind.
I think the killing of bin Laden was a mistake.
And why did it take so darn long to find this guy?
Well, first of all, the U.S. government has never been good at manhunts. The Unabomber was hiding in our own country for 20 years. It was only that his brother happened to read
his manifesto. His brother turned him in, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He read his manifesto in the New York Times. The Century Park bomber, the abortion clinic bombers, on the FBI's most wanted list for 10 years. Again, these are people in our own country with our own law enforcement. So, when you get overseas and you try to do a manhunt, and, militaries are really not designed for manhunts either. They're designed to take and hold territory. They attack strategic targets. The U.S. military is not well equipped for searching for an individual person. And as for the CIA, ever since the Church, Senator Frank Church, the Democrat from Idaho in the late 1970s, really led to a gutting of the CIA's human intelligence capabilities. The CIA has relied predominantly on what's called tech-int, or technical intelligence, phone intercepts, satellite images, and so on. And bin Laden was very disciplined about using his satellite phones or using any kind of electronic communication that we were able to listen in on. So it was harder to pinpoint him for that reason. But I think the main reason he was hard to find is, frankly, he received some very high degree of help from the Pakistani government.
Exactly.
I mean,
there's no doubt.
I've been reading the Pakistani press lately, and there's a report that came out yesterday in Dawn, which is a pro bin Laden English language newspaper. Its website's online, in which they say that according to Pakistani police took the three bin Laden widows and a number of his daughters into custody. And the widows had said that they had lived in a town called Haripur, which is a suburb of Islamabad, the capital, for 2 years before they moved to that concrete compound in Abbottabad. So in other words, they were living in urban or suburban Pakistan from 2003 onward. And if you look at where all senior al-Qaeda have been captured, of the roughly 710 or so high-level al-Qaeda operatives who killed or captured anywhere in the world.
All Pakistan.
Two-thirds of them killed and captured in Pakistan.
Yep.
Two-thirds. That's more than Iraq and Afghanistan combined. So, you know, is al-Qaeda a Pakistani organization? Is it a creature of Pakistani intelligence?
Well, and as you said, and as we know, they were the last holdouts with the Taliban and those kinds of folks.
Well, they created the Taliban. The Taliban was created by the ISI. There's no real debate about that. I mean, I think everyone in the field acknowledges that. They were created in 1994 after the U.S. and the Soviets had pulled out of Afghanistan. They needed to control. They have a doctrine called strategic depth. They believe that they'll be invaded by India, and they needed that extra depth to retreat back into in order to fight off India. And they wanted to, they'd long been in their strategic interest to dominate Afghanistan. And the Taliban, I mean, Mullah Omar, was recruited in the Pakistani city of Quetta. We have Mullah Omar's own words for this. He said this on video.
Whom they can't find now either.
Well, or who may have been killed.
Who may have been killed. That's
this
true.
Week, if you yeah. believe some reports. It might well be that the Pakistanis sense that even the Obama administration might cut them off from their $3.4 billion a year they receive in U.S. subsidies.
Of which most of that is probably lining some of their generals' pockets.
Well, that's right. I mean, President Zardari of Pakistan, the husband of Benazir Bhutto, the former prime minister who was killed by an al-Qaeda bomb, he's known in Pakistan as Mr. 10%, because for the past 25 or 30 years, he had taken a chunk of every government contract he could, you know, it's a very corrupt and unstable regime.
Yeah, Musharraf owns condominiums in Boston.
That wouldn't surprise me.
I heard that from a Pakistani in St. Louis who knows the family. This was shortly after 9/11. And he said, yeah, he owns condominiums in Boston. His son runs them.
Well, at least someone's doing something to prop up the U.S.
Economy,
real estate market.
Yeah, exactly. Unless he sold them. Maybe he got foreclosed on. Who knows? But that whole situation is bizarre. They knew he was there. God knows how long. They protected him. You know, you don't live in that kind of a house.
Well, if you look at where these major al-Qaeda figures, they're not just captured in Pakistan. They're captured in Pakistani cities. And then you look at the houses where they're captured, right? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the guy who planned the 9/11 attacks, is captured at his address. The address is 18A Nissan Road in Rawalpindi, which is just south of Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. Who owns the house? Well, the house is owned by a very famous microbiologist in Pakistan. And who is the co-owner of the house? Well, the man's wife is a leader in the largest political party in Pakistan. Then you look at other key al-Qaeda figures who've been captured in Pakistan. Abu Zubaydah, captured, you know, in the house of a retired military officer.
And these people had to know who was living in their house, if they're renting it or whatever.
Well, he was, in Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's case, KSM's case, they were, you know, the family was staying with him. Right? I mean, if you read the account of the raid, the official reports of the raid, the family was taken into custody. Now, the husband and wife who owned the house were away at a wedding, but other family members were taken into custody. And it was only when they did a search of the other rooms they found KSM asleep on the floor in one of the spare bedrooms.
Well, we're going to get into him in just a second, but I want to find out why you think we should have kept bin Laden alive.
I think there are certain things that only exist in bin Laden's head, the locations of sleeper cells, the government officials in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and other countries that are financing al-Qaeda. What is al-Qaeda's relationship to Iran? You know, what are the future plots of al-Qaeda? You know, what do they hope to do next? All of that's in bin Laden's head. And dead men tell no tales. Once bin Laden is killed, you do not get the benefit of being able to interrogate him. When we interrogated other high-ranking members of Al-Qaeda, we learned about a lot about how the organization functions, about what kind of plots are in the works, and we were able to stop plots and arrest people, sometimes, you know, with bombs in their possession.
I think that's one of the reasons we haven't taken Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to the gas chamber. You know, I think we're still milking information out of this guy.
I think it's deeper than that. I think President Obama does not want to sign the death warrant of someone who is revered in the global Muslim community. I think he's concerned about...
But he did that with bin Laden.
I think he had to. I mean, first of all, they knew where bin Laden was. I mean, according to the official accounts, I mean, this is Obama himself said that they knew that where Osama bin Laden was for more than 7 months. They set up a CIA surveillance post, and they rented a house diagonally across the street.
They could have grabbed him, put him in one of those helicopters, and off he went, right?
Sure, sure. And apparently he was unarmed. There was a AK-74U found nearby, but it wasn't in his hand. You know, it was only his three wives and a number of children with him.
Why dump the body in the sea?
You know, that is also mysterious, because you say, he was buried under, according to Muslim burial rites.
That's not Muslim burial rites.
Yeah, I mean...
it is if you die on a ship.
Right. And if you look at the USS Carl Vincent, it does not list a Muslim chaplain on board. So who read the service?
Yeah, good point.
I mean, again, nobody... There's only... There are less than two dozen Muslim chaplains in the entire U.S. military.
You are convinced we got him, right?
Yes. Okay. I don't. I mean, absent evidence to the contrary. And here's why I believe it. The Al-Qaeda websites, which are known to be official organs of the organization.
They agree he's dead.
They're mourning the loss of bin Laden.
Yeah.
You have the widows in custody. You have the physical evidence. You have the photographs. And you have the fact that Saif al-Adel is now in charge, or says he's in charge. He would never dare say he was in charge.
Of course, then again, if he shows up, then he's definitely the Antichrist, because that's what they say. The Antichrist dies and comes back. Here he is.
Well, I don't think bin Laden's about to rise on the third day.
No.
But, I mean, the structure of the organization is reacting as if he is dead. And that's impossible to fake. I think he was basically killed for political reasons.
But what if he was killed years ago, and even now Al-Qaeda has found out about it?
I think that's unlikely, given bin Laden's ongoing
dialogue,
unique abilities.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
There are financial relationships that he had with oil sheikhs to finance Al-Qaeda. That money was given to him personally.
Okay,
if he had died sooner, that money would have been cut off sooner.
So we get him, we dump his body, we never release the pictures. I don't understand that. You know,
I don't understand it either. I think President Obama was in a box because his liberal base just simply would not accept waterboarding bin Laden, holding him indefinitely at Guantanamo or some secret prison. And so politically, it would have been impossible for him to hold him. And what country in the world could we trust to take bin Laden into custody who would not face the same political problems?
Sure.
He's certainly not going to give him to the Saudis. Giving him to the Pakistanis is, you know,
laughable. Oh, you can't do that. They'd let him go. They'd throw the key in there one night when no one was looking.
You know? Right. I'd be like Pablo Escobar. I'd be able to work out of his prison cell like it's his office.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
You know, so I think, you know, there were, for the president, because of the president's politics, I think it was very hard for him to do it any other way. So do I think there was an actual kill order given? Probably not for legal reasons, but was there a wink and a nod? Quite possibly.
And whoever was in there, the SEALs who had to do it, they probably just did it on their own and said,
they are missing. There's several missing minutes of tape. They were watching it live.
Sounds like Nixon, doesn't it? In Watergate.
It does. And it makes you wonder whether the SEALs disconnected their cameras. So there are other, by the way, it wasn't just a SEAL operation. There were other special forces and CIA paramilitaries involved. But what did these guys disconnect their cameras for the kill moment with bin Laden? in order to protect themselves from being put on trial later.
And by the way, they did a great job. I am proud of the fact that they are Americans and they did what they had to do.
Absolutely. They trained for that. They set up a scale model built in plywood at Bagram of the Abbottabad compound and practiced daily until they had their movements down. It was a very expert operation. And talking to people who were, you know, involved several layers out from that operation, you know, it was, so, except for the helicopter difficulty, it was absolutely flawless. And they were able to do it without the Pakistanis detecting it, which is a miracle given that bin Laden was 800 yards from Pakistan's version of West Point.
There are a couple things going on now that confuse me, Richard. One is what's happening in the Middle East today, these apparent uprisings in all these countries. And when we haven't seen the last of them at all. I think Syria is in serious trouble if they keep attacking their protesters. So there's that on one facet. The other thing is I haven't seen the fighting back from bin Laden's death. I would have expected to have seen something somewhere. I'm concerned about that. What about you?
I'm sorry, the fighting back what?
Of you know, any retribution on the Al-Qaeda side. I haven't seen.
Oh, there have been several attacks in Pakistan.
Pakistan, but
right.
Well,
you know, it's predominantly a Pakistani organization these days. I mean, that's where its manpower and its energy is. There's the Yemeni branch, which is the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is pretty powerful. And I'm sure the Saudi reports that they're fending off constant attacks against their oil facilities by Al-Qaeda are true. That fits the pattern perfectly. And there were threats to President Obama's half-grandmother in Kenya.
And they've got her guarded pretty heavily.
Right? Right, and given the Somali branch of Al-Qaeda and the number of Somalis in Kenya now, the huge refugee community, well over a million, not just along the coast, but in Nairobi now.
But don't you feel as if this group, which is still not, you know, destroyed or splintered, even though they may be spread out, don't you think something's going to happen?
I do. I think, first of all, people underestimate how long it takes to plan terror operations that are effective.
9/11 took years.
Years. You know, 2 years of active work and probably 6 to 7 years before that.
Didn't bin Laden want to speed it up? And Mohammed kept saying, no, we're not ready. We're not going to rush into it.
Yeah, I have an entire chapter of Mastermind about that. And the bin Laden failed to understand the operational difficulties. And, of course, KSM is directly managing the day-to-day. And he had, people quitting on him. One of the 9/11 pilots, Zayed al-Jarrah, actually got on a plane in July 2001 and flew to Dusseldorf against orders to spend a week with his girlfriend, who was a Christian German woman, and who tried to talk him out of getting involved in terrorist activity. And he almost quit the organization if Ramzi bin al-Shib had not arrived and knocked on the door in Dusseldorf and got him back involved in the plot. The plot might have fallen apart right then and there. And there are numerous other cases.
We're at the top, Richard. When we come back, we shall talk about the work, Mastermind, the many faces of the 9/11 architect, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I'm George Norrie. We shall be right back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.